I've been working on this poem a lot, as you know, and I've ended up with far too many things to say about it, so I'm not going to talk about it too much. I want to discuss it. I want you guys to discuss it, read it. We'll read it together today. The only things that I'll say are to give you some statements about Eliot's novelties. There are just three novelties. He differed from the writers of his time, one by his deliberate elimination of all merely connective and traditional passages, which you've found out, right? He makes jump cuts. This is particularly the case in Wasteland, which reads like a modern or one of the something from Antonioni or some of the foreign filmmakers. But he deliberately eliminates all merely connective and traditional passages. Two, he builds up the total pattern of meaning through the immediate juxtapositions or close positionings of images without overt explanation of what they are doing together and what he wants done. Okay.
I want to write these down.
Yeah. Well, you can get these. You know, this isn't, or do you want them down now? Okay. Is to his building up of the total pattern of meaning, his building up of the total pattern of meaning through the immediate juxtapositions of images without overt explanation of what they are doing. I've wept and fasted, wept and prayed. I've seen my head brought in upon a, you know, I've seen my head grown slightly bald, brought in upon a platter, just, wait a minute, what? What's happening here?
What's the first one again?
The first one is deliberate elimination of all merely connective and traditional passages. This information you can get in most books on Eliot, but, and the third thing is the oblique reference to other works of literature.
What's oblique?
Kind of in from the side, you know, coming in from the side. He will compare a situation in world literature with a situation in his poem. And it is, I was thinking today that it's sort of a metaphorical relationship. It isn't going to be, it's like, say a woman is a harbor, yes and no. You know, if you use that as a metaphor, that there are qualities that they share, but it isn't exactly the same situation. And so when he starts the poem with the quote from Dante, you're not going to come up with an equivalent situation. Prufrock's situation is not going to be equivalent to Guido's in Dante, but it's going to be, you know, it's Guido's situation is going to shine light on Prufrock's, and Prufrock's situation probably will give you a better understanding of Guido's situation too. Anyway, those are just three things to. I don't think they're to warn. They're not warnings because you've already found out all those three things, haven't you? I mean, that's pretty clear after having read Prufrock. Okay. I will read now just the first three line stanzas of Dante's Inferno because I think it's very clear. Everyone has sensed that Prufrock's world is a hellish one. Dante is in Dante's Inferno goes down to hell. Is led through hell by Virgil. Well, I'll read you the first paragraph. The story in Dante's Inferno. Dante finds that he has strayed from the right road and is lost in a dark wood. He tries to escape by climbing a beautiful mountain, but is turned aside, first by a leopard and then a lion and finally by a she-wolf. As he is fleeing into the wood, he is stopped by the shade of Virgil, the ghost of Virgil, who tells him he cannot hope to pass the wolf and ascend the mountain by that road. The only course at present left open to Dante is to trust himself to Virgil, who will guide him by a longer way leading through hell and purgatory. From there, a worthier spirit than Virgil, Beatrice, will lead him on to see the blessed souls in paradise. Dante accepts Virgil as his master, leader, and lord. He accepts Virgil to get, you know, Virgil will lead him through hell, and they set out together. Let us go then, you and I, while evening is spread out against the sky. Okay, the first three stanzas of Dante's Inferno, the story of what it's like in hell. Midway, or 35 years, midway, this way of life we're bound upon, I woke to find myself in a dark wood, where the right road was wholly lost and gone. Let's change wood to city. Midway, this way of life we're bound upon, I woke to find myself in a dark city, where the right road was wholly lost and gone. Ah me, how hard to speak of it, that rude and rough and stubborn city. The mere breath of memory stirs the old fear in the blood. I am afraid. It is so bitter, it goes nearly to death. Yet there I gained such good that to convey this the tale, I'll write what else I found therewith. Now. And that's how the whole story of Dante's story starts. And I think you can see the metaphor there. By the way, the canto, which that is drawn out of, there's a whole bunch of stuff I've got I was writing down today and a few days ago on that, and that canto is very interesting too. And maybe later today or tomorrow we might have another session, a voluntary session, if anybody wants to hear some of the stuff I've written on this. But today, because some of you won't be here tomorrow, I do want to talk through this poem, and so I'll leave it there, and let's get right into the materials. And you haven't had a chance to read these, but I think you've probably already looked up the Luke, the story on Lazarus, and the John one on Lazarus. And on there also is the story from Genesis of Jacob's response, who wrestles out a blessing for himself. Grabs hold to another sort of a measure of a different kind of man, perhaps. And then the first excerpt is the best statement of boredom that I've ever read in my life. It's from Orwell's The Spike. That's where that line I've used before, ennui clogged our souls like cold mutton fat. Boredom clogged our souls like cold mutton fat. Our bones ached because of it. The clock's hand stood at 4, and supper was not till 6, and there was nothing left remarkable under the visiting moon. Oof, that's boredom. But if, feel free to refer to the other poems and anything you found in there that relates to this poem. You have the questions that I've given you? Should get those out. I think I kept a chronological, or I kept a orderly sequence there in the beginning. That just that first part, let us go then, you and I, when the evening is spread out against the sky like a patient etherized upon a table. Okay, who are these people? Who's the you? Okay, reader, is it you?
Himself.
Anyone else?
A part of himself.
Could be a part of himself. Anything else? Huh? At this point?
Yeah.
This is in the first line. Who is the you? Who else? Who else could it be?
God.
Hmm? God?
If it's like a confession.
What are the options so far? I can't hear.
One was the reader. The other was another part of himself, in the sense that you have, we carry on a dialogue within us. Another was God. If this is a confession, is it a confession to, say, a priest, or is it a confession, the speaker is talking to God here?
I was thinking by that explanation that Ellen's written, that it might be a kind of a collective you, maybe even a specific you, about people with whom he tries to live his life with, social acquaintance, but that's just, those unsuccessful kinds of things. Yeah, if those people are the judging people that in the other parts of the poem, yeah.
That they will say that I'm growing bald and stuff. I don't know if it would be the other people he's having difficulty with here, because he will refer later to, they will say this. You come along with me, and then that one sequence where he says, they will say that I'm like this. So I don't think it would be within that group of...
John could just be like, almost like Dante, or an image similar to the situation in the beginning, epigraph thing, where he's Montereau, whatever the guy is that's speaking this, is talking to or giving in the Inferno, he's giving an answer to Dante.
Mm-hmm.
And could it be Prufrock is giving an answer to Dante, or a Dante-type person?
Who would a Dante-type person be, the quickest?
A living soul.
Well, wait a minute. Who, particularly? Dante was a...
Jesus?
No, Dante was a poet.
Eliot?
Is the you Eliot?
It could be anyone whom you love.
Hmm?
Anyone whom you love. To the point of understanding what he's trying to confess.
Mm-hmm. And yet, he says, in the Dante thing, it's like if I thought you'd ever, he assumes the other person's in hell with him for good, and that we're in hell together. And in loving, I start thinking of who does he love? In what ways does he love anybody? Outside himself, is he affectionate here? Is he, is there somebody that he does love?
I think it's anonymous. I think it's anonymous. It's not
you.
Mm-hmm. It's like asking for help.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Anybody out there that understands where I'm at?
Mm-hmm.
I really like the idea of being Elliot, because something you said yesterday about. And some things I've been thinking about a lot this afternoon, about the difference between the artist and his work.
Mm-hmm.
And what you said yesterday about what Eliot says and what Prufrock says.
That was within a context of say, poetry or fiction, because there is a difference, I think.
Yeah.
Art, visual art is a little more direct, you know, I think.
Can be,
yeah.
I don't know, I disagree with you there, but this is the kind of... but, I don't know, I would like to read it again really quick with the idea that Eliot is the you.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I think some new things can happen.
Mm-hmm. Okay, it's changing. Now, you will change toward the end. And now, do we have to? Okay, at this point, we've come up with a bunch of good ideas. Do we have to? Are we going to pick from a number of options? Or, I mean, is there one that it's going to be?
No.
Nope.
That's why I said you, probably.
Hmm?
So
it is
a movie.
It's not any one can fit in there. But lots of different yous can be referred to. And I think the general reader, the first... You know, on one level, it's the reader. Then you can think about it and you can say, that relationship between the speaker and the I, it could mean some other things too. There's some very interesting things that you can talk about. But let's at this time just say reader. Okay. And these other things are not ruled out by saying the you means reader. The impersonal you as a pronoun does refer to numbers of people. And I think in this case it does. Let us go then, you and I, when the evening is spread out against the sky like a patient etherized upon a table. You've seen that before in the preludes. We're talking about this person stretched out. The preludes, which were on the other sheet, he uses that image in a slightly different way. Yeah, Nancy.
I'm gonna take this down and can you write notes on
them? Oh, yeah, write notes on them. Yeah. Yeah. Do anything you want with them. Let us go through certain half-deserted streets, the muttering retreats of restless nights in one-night cheap hotels and sawdust restaurants with oyster shells. Streets that follow like a tedious argument of insidious intent to lead you to an overwhelming question. Oh, do not ask, what is it? Let us go and make our visit. What setting is referred to at that first part? Well, I mean, where? What do they go through? Those few lines. What do they refer to? Hmm. Well.
Do you want a concrete?
I want a literal right now. What is it? What literally? What is being described? There.
City.
A city. What kind of city? Slum. Setting is a slum. They're going to walk through a slum, and they're going to go where? To a?
Question.
Well, what's another literal setting, physical setting, that they're going to be headed for?
In the end?
Hmm?
In the end?
Well?
Or right after this?
To a house.
You're going to go toward a, well, it's more like a drawing room, isn't it?
Oh, like the women?
Yeah, that kind of talk, tea party, drawing room, so forth. That kind of room. And then another setting that was mentioned already.
The
mind. Yeah, the mind. Okay, those would be, you know, three settings. The setting of this poem is inside the mind. This is a visit. How far do they get? You know, how far, I mean, do they go 10 yards, 100 yards? Where? Where is it? I mean...
Kind of a sanctuary, kind of retreat.
How many in actual feet is traveled here? Elise? Did you? Hmm?
Literally, you probably nowhere at all.
Well, in the mind, yeah. If it is the mind. If the mind is one of these settings.
Mm-hmm.
They say, let us go. Then they're out. Well, we'll get to that. We'll as we go through the poem. We'll get to that. Anyway, you get a sense of it. There's a slum. You go through that, and then there's a drawing room, which is very different. It isn't the oyster shells and the stink and so forth. There's a little recess, a carved out place. Yeah.
It's not where they live.
Hmm.
It's not where they live.
Yeah. It's not where they met.
They leave the environs of where they've actually lived, because where that drawing room is a visit.
Yeah. There's a visit to that they plan on making. Where they met, they is not that drawing room, and they're going to walk through this slum. Into another.
In the slum,
We don't know. We can't say that they live, you know, they're going to walk through this. We will go through certain half-deserted streets and so forth. Lead you to an overwhelming question. What do we have here? An overwhelming question? What will it be? Will there be just one? Yes? What? Elise. Oh, I thought you nodded.
Get out of your head and chill.
If there was one, it might be the one that overwhelms us all, death.
Death? Leads us to an overwhelming question.
That relates to life.
Could be death. Huh? Disturb some question that will disturb the universe? What question is asked Guido? You know?
What did you do? Why are you here?
Now, who art thou? You know, who art thou? And with the implication that the answer would involve why the guy's in hell, in the predicament that he's in. Yeah?
Another question that comes up later on, which might be part of this, is would it have been worth it? Was it worth it? I mean, even the walking through the streets to where we were going.
Mm-hmm. We'll do. The questions. Do I dare is a concrete question in there. Is it worth it? There are some particular questions in the poem. Overwhelm is when waves go over like a boat, a whelm like a wave, and then the waves go over the boat and overwhelm it. Sort of sink it. We talked about that the other day in writing tutorial. Okay, we're going to have to lead you to an overwhelming question. We do have some precise questions in the poem, as Rich said, and would those questions prove overwhelming in the course of the poem? We'll leave that open. Are there bigger questions involved? Who are you? There isn't a certain answer to that "who are you" question in the poem. Okay, but let's leave it. Let's leave these things going, and try not to get too far ahead of ourselves in the poem. Just go right, you know, as not jumping ahead. What is it? Let us go and make our visit. In the room, the women come and go, talking of Michelangelo. Now, there's a footnote on that it'd be kind of fun not to have the footnote sometimes, because that, you know, hopefully you could come to that, you know, figure that out, that particular one. But it says the many-sided Renaissance artist whose vigor, painting, sculpture, and architecture points the irony of his becoming the subject of hyper. Cultivated chit-chat in a social group whose members have none of this quality. And you get that feeling around universities, or you don't have to go to a university for that, but somehow we think that we're smart because we read smart people, or we think that we were wise because we read wise writers, we think that somehow if we just surround ourselves with a library, the intelligence of what went into those books will kind of just stick to us. If we can drop names and chat about Eliot or Michelangelo, somehow we think that we get a false sense of ourselves. And here, I think the implication is that the violence and the creativity. And the activity of this man is something that the people who are chatting have no idea of, just no idea of that kind of fire. Michelangelo was a fiery fellow. How much activity are we going to have in this poem? Movement. What things do we know for sure move in this poem? The yellow fog that rubs its back upon the window panes, and the yellow smoke that rubs its muzzle on the window panes, licked its tongue into the corners of the evening, lingered upon the pools that stand in drains, let fall upon its back the soot that falls from chimneys, slipped by the terrace, made a sudden leap, and seeing that it was a soft October night, curled once about the house and fell asleep. What animal there?
Cat.
What kind of cat? Huh? House cat.
Would it be a lion?
Hmm?
Because I don't think a jet cat having a muzzle, but I think of, you know, a lion as having a muzzle.
Hmm.
They have said muzzle.
Yeah, they do.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, he's got a tiger in his Gerontian poem, but I don't think he's got a lion in this one. Yeah. It's a town cat. It's a house cat. It goes by the slipped by the terrace, made a sudden leap, and seeing that it was a soft October night, a warm one, he decided not to go in. Maybe domestic house cat. Maybe he's let out to do his doo doo, and then decides it's going to stay outside. It's a warm night. But you get the image of this house cat. His house cat. What are the verbs in there? Did I ask that? Yeah. What are the verbs? And so what? I mean.
Can I know?
Yeah.
Can we answer the so what for why? The so what on.
Okay. So what on the house cat? Yeah. Okay. So what? Why in a poem? Why is this picture of this, of the fog, talked of in terms of a house cat?
Why is a house cat turned into pictures of the fog?
It's the yellow fog.
Why fog and smoke?
That rubs its back upon the window panes, and the yellow smoke that rubs its muzzle on the window panes. The fog is being talked of in terms of a cat. But it's the fog. Okay, why? So what? Why a cat? Of all things. And the fog. And why yellow?
The only thing I can think of is that it'd be because a cat would be quiet and stealthy and kind of an image you might want to put to smoke as far as kind of ever present, but never hearing it or seeing it. That's not right.
Even like a trained house cat is still really, you never really know about it. What it's thinking and what it's going to do is mysterious a thing of its own.
Is this sensual in any way? This passage. Rubs its back upon the window panes. Rubs its muzzle on the window panes, licked its tongue into the corners of the evening, lingered upon the pools that stand in drain, and then falls asleep. And there's where I'm talking about the, interested in the verbs too. But here's this fog, it's very sensual fog. Talked about in terms of a house cat, domesticated. It's going to stay out that night. Okay, is the fog symbolic? Does it refer to something or a number of things? Okay, what will it do? It will rub. It will rub its muzzle. It will look in, sort of peer in to something.
sorry, it kind of gets the impression of the fog trying to get into the house.
And later it does get in, doesn't it?
Sitting between the
between
75 and 80. 79, stretched on the floor, here beside me. If it is.
That's an afternoon to evening. Yeah. Talks of the afternoon or the evening as if it could be a cat falling asleep on the floor.
John, is there when I see fog and smoke, I think of them as two distinct things.
What's that? Fog and?
Fog and smoke.
Yeah.
He uses them both. And then I don't think he uses, I don't know if he, I don't recall that he uses smoke again, but fog.
Yeah, go ahead. This is, come on. We're this is an ambiguous poem, so and there's no this answer. You know.
Fog like afternoon.
Well, I thought maybe the fog being outside the house and then somehow gets into the house and the same yellowness of the fog is the smoke from the fire within the house, and that later lies between. So the description of the fog and description of the smoke to fog. I know that it turns into smoke, but the same type of lingering, whatever it is now inside the house.
One's fire and one's water. Okay.
Is there?
One's decaying through burning, and one's evaporation. Boom, boom. They may ride together. You know, like there's a fog and there's also chimneys blasting up smoke, and it makes it darker and thicker, and more like a cat.
And yellow, yeah. Yellow fog would be what? When fog is yellow, smog.
Mm-hmm.
And the soot keeps falling on it.
It's sneaky.
Yellow. This imagery.
You're surrounded before you even know it.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, it's deadly.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it can kill you. And a cat creeps. I think of sandbirds.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
little cat feet.
Little cat feet. And later on in the poem, he talks about I should have been a pair of ragged claws.
Mm-hmm.
Scuttling across the floors of silent seas. Claws don't scuttle.
Mm-hmm.
Fog scuttles. The idea of claws in that in that fog makes a whole kind of almost demonic. It curls around the house. Choking.
Mm-hmm. Choking.
So the fog could be an image of like smog. Yellow, like Los Angeles, something like that.
Could be.
Ocean, dirt. Mm-hmm. Like getting in a possibility. Like Tim mentioned, you know, in a house cat, even a house cat, trained in a house cat. And the feeling is that kills, or something in it, that it could be you, and or because of you, because of it, you can be done. And there's a real, and ambivalence there. It's either it or it's because of it. And it's the claws, and or it's because it's surrounding you and you can't see that you run into something and get killed.
Mm-hmm.
The images flew away.
I was thinking also about in Los Angeles and this soft October night, that there's like thinking of a soft night as being maybe no breeze, mild.
Mm-hmm.
Thinking in Los Angeles, when the fog stays there, it's a temperature inversion,
mm-hmm.
they call it. And if this guy is in mine, it's he's turned in and it's locked there,
mm-hmm.
and it can't get out. And what he's doing is, and then he curls around it and he puts more. And just
mm-hmm. Is it consciousness at all? Consciousness.
Is it
fog
consciousness?
Mm-hmm. Could it be?
Those could be the tedious arguments. Just da 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 da, and it just and you don't have an end. They go around in a circle.
John, just maybe a thought too.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's kind of important in life, that bracketed on at top and bottom of the movement of the fog is Michelangelo. Mm-hmm. And I guess I kind of see more in Michelangelo than last night. I spent a whole hour trying to think of other names of artists that would rhyme.
Mm-hmm.
There was a whole bunch of them that would have fit.
Mm-hmm.
And Michelangelo, his motifs of pietà, of slave trying to get out,
mm-hmm.
of that bound block, and of the Last Judgment, makes that creeping fog very, you know, while people are just running back and forth, you know, like, you know, Michelangelo this, Michelangelo that. What Michelangelo is talking about is that yellow fog that's rubbing up against you.
Mm-hmm. Okay. That's where symbolic, a symbol is so rich. You know, a symbol is when you don't tack down it. You know, oh, the symbol means X. The symbol means X and Y,
yeah,
and Z. And the worst thing to do is to say a symbol means ping. And that isn't what a symbol does. You're trying to make a symbol into an allegorical thing, and that isn't it. So this whole image of this, the dangerousness of this, comes in. I keep seeing you move. I keep thinking. That's something to say. Others?
I also sort of think about, with the references to the sea and the reference to the oyster shells, I sort of think of a fog like from the ocean. How like that musical or something just coming in, just sort of sitting there all the time, at least sort of eerie at night, especially.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And the ocean is generally, I think you can see the ocean as a symbol that's a lot like that too. It's light, I mean, the ocean is water, light, and yet being overwhelmed.
And we'll have drownings in here, won't we?
Mm-hmm. There's a definite positive and negative sense that we're thinking about here. Consciousness being what I would think would be a real positive kind of putting the fog in a positive light, whereas I somehow get a feeling of it being a product of the city and the slums that has just come out of,
But even though he doesn't live in the city in the slums, this yellow fog pervades, this polluted yellow fog pervades his whole consciousness, his whole way of thinking.
It's just like we talked in the Bible study about the city being everywhere, even though you're out on the edge, you're still dealing with the city, you know, the commerce or whatever. You take the city with you wherever you are.
Well, the city, the fog comes in over the whole city, over the drawing room.
Mm-hmm. Is there any connections between the oyster shells and the first thing and the ocean thing in the last? Is that the end of the thing? Or is that something you want to wait?
I don't see a major connection there. Let me say a few things. This is the one passage, there are two passages in the poem that have color imagery. Black and white aren't colors. And this is one of them. The fog is yellow. Color of jaundice, things. Smog, etc. And at the end we'll have color in a dream. The red and brown, seagirls wreathed in red and brown, seaweed, red and brown. And in a dream you'll have color, and here in this fog you'll have color. the sea at the end is going to move, you know? It's going to be a moving thing. The wind is going to be moving then. The fog is moving now. What else moves? What else moves here in the poem? Two things that move are a fog and a dream. A fog and a dream. I asked a question about could this be a outline to the poem? And let's just read. The window panes, the fog is outside, and you're going to look inward, inside, to see what you're going to find. Proof rocks, outside. Rubbing his back up against himself. Proof rock is rubbing his muzzle on the window panes. Is he looking in? Licking his tongue into the corners of the evening, the darkest places of the evening, lingering upon the pools that stand in drains, backed up sewers. Is he going to linger there on the backed up sewers? Is he going to somehow let fall the dirt? Is he going to make a sudden leap in the poem? Will he make a sudden leap? And then, seeing that it's late in the year is over the hill, the greatness of the year has flickered, will he curl once about his body, which is talked of in Durantian as a rented house, and fall asleep? Will he do this in the poem? There's a odd parallel here. And what's the image? If proof rock is somehow doing this, that's a consciousness, and what's that consciousness like? It's a yellow fog. It's hard to see through. Colors things in a jaundiced way. It takes this certain tint.
Like a patient, eager eyes upon a patient.
Yeah. And it's going to be like that. He doesn't use the color there, but the sickness aspect is definitely, you know, there, a connection there. The sensual imagery here, you know, sight, taste, touch, and you have smell. We don't have smell here. We don't have hearing here. But you have these other things. Where is the other touch and the movement? And where are the other images? What are the images in this poem? What live images do you have in the poem? What things are alive in the poem? What things are colored in the poem? What things move in the poem? What
Riddle
things...
Riddled up against the wall.
Hmm?
Riddled up against the wall.
Mm-hmm. That's when a person moves, isn't it? The woman's arms are going to be across the table.
Descending the stairs?
No, that's do I dare.
Women coming and going.
Do I dare? Time to turn back and descend the stair. The people that are moving here are chatting about Michelangelo. But okay, what kinds of movements are there? Is this an outline? Somehow, what's going to happen during this poem? If I won't say that now. But will there be an October night? And will then the response be to fall asleep? Okay, and indeed there will be time. The yellow smoke that slides along the street, rubbing its back upon the window panes. There will be time. There will be time to prepare a face to meet the faces that you meet. There will be time to murder and create. Is there a relationship between murdering and creating and preparing a face to meet the faces that you meet? What would be murdered? Preparing a face to meet the faces that you meet.
Real self.
Real
self. Person and personage.
Get it to a person or personage. You know, just my person.
Murder the person to create the.
Personage.
Personage.
Mm-hmm. Create.
Also murder other personages too.
There is a. You tend to do it. If you do it to yourself, you're doing it to other people too. There will be time. There will be time. There will be time. It almost sounds like he protests. Too much. There will be time. There will be time. There will be time. And what will happen later? There'll be time for all these things to happen. There'll be time to prepare a face to meet the faces that you meet. There will be time to murder and create, and time for all the works and days of hands that lift and drop a question on your plate. Time for you, and time for me, and time for 100 indecisions, and for 100 visions and revisions. That's one of the favorite lines. Visions and revisions, you know. Or time for 100 visions and revisions before what? Great moment? The taking of toast and tea. What? What moment is that? What kind of a moment is that?
Something I just kind of never thought of before, but 100 visions and revisions. 100 visions in itself. One vision is all most people need or have. You think of a man or one person or vision, not having 100 visions.
Of the kind of visions we have hundreds of, what are they?
Dreams.
Dreams, fantasies.
And if you even want to think of inspired visions, they don't say, they just say time for 100 visions, and that could almost be, you know, gee, I've had time for 100 visions and I haven't had one yet. Shucks.
And yet thinking that there's time. There's time enough yet. I don't have to act. I mean, right now, there's time for me to have these visions yet. And then, time yet for 100 indecisions, for 100 visions and revisions. What kind of person is getting a vision and then a revision? It's treating a vision in a very strange way, is to revise it, you know, isn't it? I mean, you treat a vision in a very, just isn't the kind of thing that you do, but you get a vision and then you revision it. What?
Correcting the word, correcting the promise.
Revising? Yeah.
But when you revise something, aren't you just questioning it?
But do it again and again. This means a lot to me as a poet who likes to polish his work. Ha! 100 visions and revisions. What kind of a person is continually...
I think it's sort of a gutless one.
Is it gutless? Scared?
Rationalizing.
Rationalizing? Not rationalizing. I don't think you'd use that word. Anne?
I think it's just a normal person. Don't we all question and revise our lives?
100 indecisions of... I think that we are involved in that. But whether, you know, would we say, should it be that way?
It's like an inverted statement. Usually if you talk about yourself or what you, who you are or where you've been, I mean, you talk about determining what you did decide. And you might bring into consideration the things you thought about instead or things you're not decided about. But looking back is usually looking at decisions made and what happened, not 100 indecisions. I mean, I think that's just even the man on the street sort of response is, why did this, and I married her, and I got a house, and I took this job, and I got it out instead of, like, wondered if I should, and, you know. It's like an inverted, not that everybody doesn't stand in that place, but that we don't usually, it's like an inverted, typical, the typical statement of the decisions one.
Mm-hmm.
About yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And that this is like the inside out
mm-hmm.
statement.
Mm-hmm.
What has it really been?
Has
it really been 100?
Revision is often the vision canceling.
Canceling it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, it's like imposing. You know.
Mm-hmm.
It's
no vision,
it's
a dream.
Yeah.
Yeah. They cancel each other. That's that sense of canceling is really good. And also, when you say, indeed, there will be time to do, you know, I'm going to retire, and then there'll be time to travel, there'll be time to go to the museums, there'll be time to read those books, there's going to be time to have the good times, there'll be time to do this, and this, and this, and this. There's time for good things, right? There's going to be time this year for you to do have lots of bum conversations. There's going to be plenty of time for you to be indecisive, to get a big idea and then shoot the bottom out from under it. What kind of, there's that inversion that Elisa's talking about. There's a, whoa, there's going to be time for before something happens, very significant happens, there's going to be time, like you're leaving, say, here, or but in terms of a life, death. There's going to be time before something very significant like a judgment or death happens. And what will there be time for? What are those good things? A yellow smoke slide across the street, rubbing its back upon the window panes. There will be time, there will be time, there will be time to... Here's another good thing, prepare faces to meet the faces that you'll meet. There will be time to murder and create.
That cancels.
Murder what and create what? I mean, there's that personage business too. To murder the person and create the personage.
But can going you create on after you've murdered?
Hmm?
You've lost out.
You've already lost.
You lost the chance to create if you've murdered.
Well, you go plus one, minus one. Or minus one, plus one, I should say. That kind of thing. Yes?
Vision.
Yeah.
The whole thing is outside of its order because even the saying there will be time and all that is like somebody who's I'm in control here. It's my world, it's my life, I have love off. And I can murder, and the real, you know, we can murder. We obviously can't create nothing that takes the place of murder.
I think the create will, you know, is picked up. Yeah, well, the murder and creating in the visions and revisions, you know, it's picked up down here. What are we going to create? And then what's going to happen to it? Okay, and what's the significant thing that's waiting there for you and me? I mean, what is the significant thing that's waiting for us, we're invited into this, in this world? What is this, the works and days of hands? The footnote on that is to a poem in praise of harsh agricultural toil, and is in an ironic contrast to Prufrock's world, and it's creating of Michelangelo too. Perhaps that's why we have that down beneath, you know, that part is encapsulated there. But There's time for all the works and days of hands. And what does the works and days of hands produce?
Question.
Lift and drop a question on your plate. What kind of meaningless, trivial thing is going on there? And all the works and days of hands will produce what?
So, the creation should be the working of hands and days should be an answer for the question. Should be hopefully dropping an answer on your plate, not a question.
To drop a meaning, yeah, instead of a questioning the meaning. Eating will come up again. Mm-hmm. Beautiful. Incredible one. Often. Tremendous.
Can you go back and create the works and days of hands is the agricultural, that's something that's created, and that's a question.
Say that again. Would you?
It's created and doesn't know how. That's dropped in the creation.
You just ticked off something in my head, and it swallowed what you were saying. And you said, when you started talking about the sort of but the harsh agricultural toil, and then there's this, what's that? We don't know where it is, what it is, where it comes from, or anything like that.
Any relationship between the Old Testament, a time for this and a time for that, there's a time for this, mm-hmm. a time to plant, a time to sow, mm-hmm. a time to kill, a time mm-hmm. to heal, mm-hmm. and yet on here there's only time for the one side of it. I mean,
it's not a time or the time, it's time.
You would think if there were a time for planting, all the works, you know, and days of hands, mm-hmm. but then the biblical thing says there's a time to sow.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But for him, the sowing time is just a question dropped on his plate. Like mm-hmm. he's just sitting there waiting. Mm-hmm. And it's got this empty plate, and there's no harvest.
And what's supposed to sustain him? A question. A whole series of questions.
Yes, yes.
And not any... The certainty is gone. Remember the Dover Beach thing. The certainties are dead. There is no certainty. So we've got questions, and we're trying to sustain ourselves on a diet of questions. Continual questions. Indecisions. There's a whole... we've lost our... direction. Oh, the scholar gypsy thing is good here too.
Drop?
Yeah.
Okay. I don't know those two lines really.
Well, you think of raising a question and dropping an answer, but it just gives you a question.
The backwards again, yeah.
Yes, this is a question.
That's another canceling. This whole thing is just full of one thing mm-hmm. canceling another thing. Murder and creating, vision and revision, lifting and dropping.
And everything goes back to the same level that what it began with. There's no change.
But all the first things that he starts out with are the vision, lift, there's work.
He
starts saying that. I don't know. Anyway.
Yeah. Well, another thing on here. Don't worry, you've got time for 100 indecisions. You know, before the last judgment day, you're going to have hundreds of indecisions. You know, that's a positive thing I have to say to you. What? And 100 visions and revisions. Before what? What's this last, this big moment? Taking of toast and tea. Again, you've got the great judgment day becomes tea time. Sort of a trivialization. In the room, the women come and go talking of Michelangelo. Tea time, parlor, drawing room. Again, that contrast. There's a sense of when that's repeated, it's sort of a pendulum. Nothing changes. Tick, tock. They're doing the same thing they were doing before. Tick, tock. Time, the whole thing, time stanza, has this, you know, instead of pendulum swinging from opposite, you know, from opposites, you've got the same thing on both sides as time goes on.
Do you see that the tea and toast is as being the last judgment?
Well, as the significant moment. What is the significant moment we measure? We have time. You know, I've got time before I die, you know, or before, and that will there be a judgment then, or there's a significant moment in time, end time, before the end time. And here, the end time becomes the taking of toast and tea. There will be time before what? The taking of toast and tea.
I also see that whatever it is, that significant moment, you know, it's a real statement of what he feels, that significant moment that you just work and work and work to try and, you know, build up or get in before that, and always having a vision then of that being so important, really is only toast and tea.
That's right. Okay, that's good. Time to prepare to meet what? You know, that's what you're saying, right? To prepare to meet the big moment. And what is the big moment? What is the big moment going to be that one needs to prepare for? Is it to walk into a room? And indeed, there will be time to wonder, do I dare? Do I dare? Time to turn back and descend the stair. And go away from what? Get out of there. Get out of where? Get away from what? What? Where are they going to visit? Let's make our visit. I go through the slums. The toast and tea room. Do I dare go into this room where women come and go talk to Michelangelo?
It seems to me that like they're avoiding the question all the time, or a question.
Mm-hmm.
Do I dare to answer, to take time to answer the question?
Mm-hmm.
To God or to disturb the universe?
Mm-hmm.
Do I dare take this?
Mm-hmm.
And to run it up?
Mm-hmm.
So that I can eat?
Mm-hmm. It's kind of funny. The way, you know, isn't it that all the big questions are postponed until do I dare is answered? I think that's another way of saying what you said there. Do I dare?
They kind of remind me too of if I ask that rule, what should I get up for today? I'll never get out of bed.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay, you leave he doesn't purposely say, do I dare what?
Yeah.
He doesn't nail it down to one particular thing. He says, do I dare? Do I dare? Doesn't answer that. He just says, well, there's time to turn back from this room and descend the stair. Go back down, get away from this very significant thing that's toast and tea. going to happen there.
Isn't that the meal you give to sick people?
What?
That's the meal, well, my mother gives to us when we're sick, toast and tea.
Yeah, toast and tea.
Typically English, too.
Yeah.
I thought of it as being breakfast, too, as a breakfast time. Later on, the food changes to marmalade as in the afternoon.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
really
after the hunt. And then cakes and ices after evening music.
Okay.
But I'm
the watch the food is really important. I don't know, I myself haven't watched, been alert to the changes in the food. Mm-hmm. Except that roast beef and potatoes, it ain't.
Yeah.
You know. Yeah. Cakes and teas and ices and toast and toast.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
In the book that you referred us to about talking about Eliot's poem, I can't remember the name of the book, but when you told us to look at Stan poetry,
mm-hmm.
They talk about if there's two sides of Eliot and or a proof rock, which one just gets toast and tea and which one gets the icing.
Mm-hmm.
That's one of the questions.
Which book was that? Which therapy?
It's got the cosmic front on it, the blue and white. What is it?
Is that the Pocket Poetics?
Pocket Poetics. I looked at Rudy before I did it. What?
Well, you show it to me afterwards. I can't remember.
Which one was it you were reading?
The C.K. Stead's something he does, some criticism on Eliot?
It's a small paperback, and it goes from Eliot's last guys.
He
does.
He uses
a guy named poetry from some guy to Eliot.
Guy named Williamson that they refer to. This
yeah, that's it.
Well, you show it to me later. I can't. My head isn't on that. I don't know. There. But does he dare? He's up on. Yes, Elise, you've got your hand up. Oh, Rich is. Oh, boy, there are hands all over the place. Yes.
Just one more idea to throw into the hopper. When Cockney people talk, they make rhymes for that mean other things. Mm-hmm. So, cakes and ale is going to jail.
Mm.
And so they just, when somebody's going to jail, they just say he's cakes and ale.
Mm.
And the Cockney children have a song they sing when they skip rope. And it goes, toast and tea, wait and see, eternity, the end of me.
Say that again?
Yeah.
This is the, what?
Toast and tea, wait and see, eternity, the end of me.
And where is this from?
This is a folk thing that Cockney children jump rope to.
Okay, I got to do this, Cockney. I got to write this down.
Cockney language is all full of rhymes that actually mean other things, and I have no idea whether T.S. Eliot was thinking of toast and tea as being, you know, as that, but it's kind of neat.
Yeah.
Toast and tea, wait and see, eternity, the end of me.
It sure would fit because it is in the slums and it's sort of a London fog.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And the other thing too that it seems like that Eliot is just a master of bringing in the references from all over the place.
Yeah,
I mean, anything mm-hmm. will add to the it's like a dimension. Like it's like a shorthand almost.
Mm-hmm.
He's got this, but really he's saying this, this, and this, and this. If you know enough, come into that line,
mm-hmm.
you will get all these things.
Mm-hmm.
And that sounds like a perfect frame for that part.
As somebody very interested in England, he would, you know, he could be aware of that. He wrote this while he was at Harvard. When he may have been to England, I don't know, but he didn't go to England until after, you know, after he wrote this poem. He wrote this in 1910. It was published in 17. But he could very well have been aware of that, as he was aware of an awful lot, you know, at 22 to be able to write this. But that is really good. And Tim.
Yeah, I was just thinking about
also, in this poem, I thought about, really thought about English, wholesome tea, or like American coffee breaks. People just living for that time, or also for meal time, meal to meal, or something about in between. Wasn't there just something we were reading about 4 o'clock, stop the clock before 6 time?
That's from Orwell.
Oh. So, you know, living from meal to meal time, or something, and that, paying attention to between that. Something steadily, always the same.
What are the significant moments, and it's what can happen at this, and he says later, on this diet.
Like all England too, don't they? All, everybody stops for morning tea, lemon teas, and afternoon tea. This is really important.
The big times. Yeah, I remember making a few years ago talking about what you said, and I can't get it back in my head. There was some kind of a thing on did on these times and what were then the significant times and what was eaten and so forth. Now, and it was a long time ago. But I'll see if I can't find some stuff to talk to you at least about it.
I think
yeah.
I saw this in kind of a different frame, but I saw toast and tea maybe as convenient.
Toast and tea? As communion or as a contrast to communion?
An irony?
I don't know, that just
the
communion and the sacrament just came into my mind.
I
didn't.
A secular sacrament?
Well, in line 87, when it talks about
that's
what
a very
it
good.
Worth it? After the cups of marmalade and tea among your porcelain among some coffee you and me, would have been worthwhile to have bitten off the matter with a smile, not wear your minds out when you go to take a sacrament. Is it something you just do? Are you a Sunday Christian?
Then you look at it.
That's intriguing right there, that I don't know.
You talk about
this is the kind of yep. This is what happens with this poem. You can spend time and it just keeps growing. And I think that the he needn't have been aware, consciously aware, and put that in there. You know, for me to say, wow, secular sacrament. Body and blood? No. Toast and tea. As an ironic kind. The fact that it's such a contrast, he does other contrasts like this in here, and the fact that he was very well-versed in religious matters through his mother. Whether he was conscious of it or not, I think that's behind it, an ironic contrast. Definitely on the diet later. And he plays with that in Gerontian too, where we... instead of eating body and blood, Christ eats us. We eat a number of sort of vegetables and we become what we eat. Yeah, Elise. No, you can't move. Yeah.
When I look at this with that as the attitude of communion, the idea of communion, it seems like he never even gets there. It's before making that commitment, making that decision. He'll just go through all these rationalizations and revisions and decisions, and then never even stepping out to take, never even taking the toast and tea. You know? It's always out there, but he'll never make the decision whether to take it or not.
Mm-hmm. Will he dare even to take that sacrament? Mm-hmm. I mean, or he's standing there, he says, I can get away, I can still back out and go down the stair. Will he dare to even take that sacrament? Yeah.
That line really also about if we don't eat him, we'll eat each other.
Mm-hmm.
This is almost even a step further. We devour ourselves. We don't get so into murder, we can't step outside of at his point.
Start to starve to death, and the introversion works on the with the fog business too.
This guy is caught going and coming. He can't go because he's not sure that he should. Do I dare? And if he goes and then he comes back, it'll embarrass him because he's got a bald spot in the middle of his head.
Mm-hmm.
So he can't turn around.
Mm-hmm.
He's go forward or backward.
He's surrounded. The fog business that,
yeah.
You know, that he seems like there's no escape from any.
And the smoke and the smoke fog. It's a kind of suffocating thing that even without moving you can't put setting in that topic.
Mm-hmm.
Really makes that it's a perfect thing to me anyway, a perfect groundwork for understanding how tremendous a statement, how tremendously freeing Luther's statement of sin boldly is for me
because it is, you cannot make that perfect step in any direction.
Mm-hmm.
And so
you ultimately
completely
up to the walled in on
every side by yourself. Okay, well, that's getting ahead, but sin boldly is very important here. One of the reasons why this is on the book list, why we spend time with it.